Welcome, Monsignor.
Thank you, Teresa.
We are in show number 62, mm-hmm. volume 3, and we're in chapter 12. We started this chapter talking about Monsignor Hellriegel, mm-hmm. and we have had just a fantastic look at the beginning of his life. We pretty much left off last week with just him being named a Monsignor and mm-hmm. given his first and only, I guess, parish. Yeah. So I can't wait to hear more.
He had studied a lot. I mean, I mentioned last week that he had a wonderful library on this. One of those that I came across, and I was very much inspired by, is a multi-volume set called The Year of Grace. And it's written by a Benedictine, Father Pius Parsh. It's, of course, the traditional Latin Mass. It was written before the Second Vatican Council. And it takes apart the liturgy, every word, every gesture, and relates everything. You know, the year that I was the rector for the oratory of St. Gregory and Augustine,
yes,
I used Pius Parsh week after week after week just to open up the liturgy for me. What a beautiful experience that was. And so Father Hellriegel was reading these books, and not just Pius Parsh, but many others.
Tell me the name of that book again.
Yeah, it's called The Year of Grace.
The Year of Grace.
The other thing, too, about Monsignor Hellriegel is that he didn't keep this stuff to himself. Instead, he shared this with others.
Good.
And especially his assistant pastors. And these guys fell in love with him and emulated him. And so when he finally retired, the next pastor was none other than Father Paul Zipfel. And he continued on the tradition at Holy Cross. That was the standard bearer for this liturgical reform. And again, we're talking about real reforms, like the Easter Vigil Mass and others. We're not talking about balloon masses.
Right.
Okay. So he continues that on. Another priest who was also an assistant to him was Monsignor Nicholas Schneider. And again, you know, very steeped into the liturgy. For many years, was the chairman of the Liturgical Commission for the Archdiocese. And he steered this archdiocese through some very difficult times. He's keeping the boat afloat while Leviathan is all around. So, again, a great influence and a liturgist. I was very honored and blessed to be able to serve under him at St. Monica's, which was my first assignment as a priest. Another person who was a collaborator with Monsignor Hellriegel was Dr. Marie Kramer. Presently, she is residing in Most Holy Trinity Parish, but she had a lot of influence over liturgical music, good, solid liturgical music throughout this archdiocese also. So you had those people. He even wrote a hymn that's used in many parishes to Jesus Christ, our Sovereign King.
I love that song. Isn't
it? Yeah, he wrote that in 1941.
And that song's known worldwide, I think.
Yeah, it is, yeah. There was a liturgical conference that was held on March 12th of 1965, just about a half year later after the liturgical week, and it concerned itself with liturgical changes.
Okay.
Later on that same year, Cardinal Ritter wrote to his priest, and he said the following. He said, and I quote here, "We must take care to use carefully the adaptations now at hand. The church, the community of worship, suffers from ill-considered activities of zealots as much as from pastoral inaction." And then he went on to say this, "If in this hour of opportunity and danger, the church is not to be reduced to a state of chaos, the whole-hearted and loving obedience of all is a matter of compelling urgency." So he's already getting reports about things that are being done.
Without approval.
Yeah. You know, the fact of the matter is, if he was concerned about pastoral inaction, in other words, a pastor simply not implementing the decrees of the council and the guidelines, that simply was not the case. I don't know of any instance of anybody foot-dragging on this. The other part of it is, though, as he says, ill-considered activities of zealots mm-hmm. was something to be worried about. Interesting, some of the things that he cautioned against are things that ultimately are going to be approved. But later on, he writes also this, "These practices have deservedly caused wonderment among the faithful. It is my obligation to see that our people are not victimized by those who have a flair for the singular and unauthorized, no matter what the motivation of the lone clergyman is."
And so it's not yours to play around with.
Yeah. And in that letter, he actually also warned that if things were serious enough, he would remove faculties of the priests. So the fact of the matter is that there were people, there were priests who were praying the canon in English, unauthorized. You know, that was supposed to have been retained in Latin. Some of them were adding words and changing. You probably have had that experience.
Absolutely, we have. Mm-hmm.
Gestures that are not part of the rubrics, you know. He spoke also of, and I quote here, the indiscriminate distribution of Holy Communion under both species. That was not allowed at the time, and yet there were priests who were doing it sometimes regularly. Celebrating Mass outside of church or outside of a chapel. That becomes rather common practice. But again, you could only do that with permission, and you might as well forget it. You weren't going to get permission.
Okay.
You know, but some people were doing that.
Wow.
Those kind of things that were going on. And so this letter that came out in 1966 actually was intended to target specifically. There were 125 priests and laity who were pushing for this stuff. Mm-hmm. And they even had an organization. They called themselves the Christian Experiment.
I don't even know what to say about that. The Christian Experiment.
The Christian Experiment. So they're going to
the
do their own experimenting.
The mass is not an experiment.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, you can tell them that.
Yes, right, right.
Yeah. This got into the newspapers. The St. Louis Review was quite sympathetic to them. The editor of the paper. The Review was a rather loose cannon. At this particular time, and we'll see this a little bit later on, it's going to be Cardinal Carberry who's going to have to get the Review back in line.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. And then, of course, the Post-Dispatch, as you can well imagine.
Well, I can imagine that, but I didn't imagine the Review would be it.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Well, in fact, the Post-Dispatch had some articles about the Christian Experiment. They kind of did a conservative-liberal thing. You know, these are liberals, and then they had to find conservatives, so they called this group the Conservative Elements of Cardinal Ritter's Staff. And they even named names of some of his assistants. And then they went on to say that they were afraid that the St. Louis Review, their fellow newspapermen, journalists, were going to be persecuted by the archdiocese and by this conservative element. They went on to say this. They said that since the St. Louis Review does not pay for itself through subscriptions and is subsidized by the archdiocese, that it's going to lose its independence. And then the editorial, this is a St. Louis Post-Dispatch editorial, says this: if the liberals continue to be ignored, their views causing exile will be an open revolt to be touched off, as in the case of Los Angeles. Now, I don't know what was going on in Los Angeles at the time, but
I don't suspect that the people of St. Louis would have done that.
No, no, that's for sure. Well, some of them.
Well, certainly. There's always going to be some.
Yeah, that 125 members of the Christian Experiment.
That were part of the experiment. Yeah. Right, certainly. And yeah, you never know what some people can drum up, you know. But the tradition, the history of St. Louis, imagine that that would have been
No, it wouldn't be
here.
Widespread, no. And it wouldn't have been widely supported either, you know, besides having to deal with all this stuff. The other area that Cardinal Ritter was very enthusiastic about was ecumenism. And he formed together in December of 1964 the Archdiocesan Commission on Ecumenism. And he hosted a dialogue at Kenrick Seminary. At this time, 228 clergymen throughout St. Louis attended. And of the 228, there were 92 Catholic priests attending. And the speaker at this time was Monsignor William Baum. Now, he's a priest of the Kansas City Diocese. He was, at the time, a peritos at the Second Vatican Council. He is an alumnus of Kenrick Seminary and our highest-ranking clergyman. He was made a cardinal. That won't happen until 1976, but he addressed this group then on ecumenism. And so there was a lot of talk about pulpit exchanges and common prayer services and all things like that. And so the commission itself began writing up guidelines. It's one of the interesting things about getting into an archives is that you see the stuff that wasn't published. Normally, it's just the stuff
that gets published,
the stuff that comes out at the end. But there was an earlier draft that I came across. It was marked confidential, and it was never published. And it said that under certain circumstances that priests could hear the confessions of Protestants.
Oh, okay.
And in case of danger of death, they could even distribute viaticum. Well, yeah, well, somebody got a hold of that, and they started looking at it more seriously, and obviously that didn't happen. Instead,
and why it was confidential and not
published.
Yeah,
that's right, not published, yeah. But you can see how some people were pressing the envelope.
Pushing the envelope.
On June 11th of 1965, the document called A Directive on Ecumenism was published, and I found that to be very interesting because it said the following, and I quote here, "Intercommunion is viewed as a goal to be obtained rather than as a means of achieving unity." So somebody had their mind in the right place at that point. August of 1964, we experience a mass that's preached in the vernacular. It's done, of course, with special permission. And then later on, a month after the mass, then you have the publication of the document that gives the guidelines for the document is Sacrosanctum Concilium, right?
Yes.
Okay, but the guidelines, and if you read through that, it's a beautiful document, but it doesn't tell you exactly what you can do and what you can't do.
Okay.
And so later on then, in September of 1964, the document Inter Ecumenici is then published, and that's going to give specific guidelines. Now, since then, we have something called the General Instruction of the Roman Missal.
Yes.
And that's at the front of the Roman Missal. It's a long document and 40, 50 pages long. I'm pretty sure that every seminarian practically has memorized that. Because I know when I was in the seminary, we were tested on that, and we weren't going to get out of that class until we knew exactly what was in that document. So that's the General Instruction of the Roman Missal. But this kind of precedes that.
Okay.
Okay. Again, you know, things are happening very quickly. The dialogue, the fourth annual dialogue that takes place in December of 1964, literally is held just a few weeks after the document on ecumenism, Unitatis Integration, is published. You barely have time to even read it before you're implementing it already. Yeah, everything's happening very quick.
Yes.
And then, besides the Christian experiment, there's another group that gets together. These are priests and laity, and they call themselves the Little Council. They're going to make suggestions for the implementation of the Second Vatican Council, even while the council is going on. As I say, there are about 30 priests and laity. They get together, and they come up with all these ideas for a renewal of the church in St. Louis. And they sent a copy to Cardinal Ritter in 1964. He read over it and sent it back to the priest who was in charge of that little group and said, it's too complex and you forgot parishes. When we renew, we're going to renew by parishes. From the Little Council's point of view, that was a slap in the face.
Okay.
You know, he's not being collaborative. So what did they do? They leaked the letters to the National Catholic Reporter, which published the whole thing, October of 1965. So in order to try to keep some kind of control over what's going on, remember, the cardinal is out of town half the year. He's at the council.
Right.
You know, and so in order to get some kind of control over all of this, he then created what he called the St. Louis Archdiocesan Assembly. And so that kind of makes the Little Council redundant. And so he creates that, but then he also has to deal specifically. There were four priests who at this moment just went off the reservation. And they're doing whatever they want to, and the whole works. And he has to call them in. One of them is the assistant editor of the St. Louis Review. And so, anyway, he was reassigned. He was taken out of that role. He was given the parish as a pastor. And in 1970, he left the priesthood. There was another who was the director of the Archdiocesan News Bureau. That's, you know, basically the Office of Communications today. He was off the rails himself, and then he was given a parish. He was taken out of that, but given a parish, and in 1967, he left the priesthood. And then there was another who was an assistant to the executive director for the Archdiocesan Commission on Sacred Liturgy, as well as Sacred Music, as well as Sacred Art. He was replaced, and he ended up leaving the priesthood in 1968. The director of the Commission on Sacred Liturgy, the Commission on Sacred Music, and the Commission on Sacred Art. He was taken out of those positions also, and he was sent out to O'Fallon to become the chaplain of the sisters out there.
Okay.
Taking the position that Monsignor Hellrich once held. And he served out there faithfully the rest of his life.
Oh, okay.
A lot of priests have a lot of respect for this man. I attended his funeral just last year. And, there was a good number of priests, older priests, who knew him and respected the fact that he had taken his obedience and did well with it. However, there were two younger priests who saw all of this happening, and they turned around and they wrote a really mean editorial, and I believe it was in the Post-Dispatch. They signed this editorial, and one of them left the priesthood in 1968 and the other in 1969. So you see a trend here?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
I do.
Well, Cardinal Ritter then, again, is trying to get control of all of this, and so he institutes something he calls Operation Renewal, and this is in 1966. It's quite extraordinary. Now, he's going to approach this from a parish point of view. That's the renewal come about through the parishes, and he's going to introduce 2,600 study groups in various parishes. So obviously, some parishes are going to have many study groups.
Right. Yeah, we certainly don't have 2,000 parishes.
No.
We need that many.
Right. Yeah. These are like small groups, uh-huh. 8, 10, 5, whatever, groups of people get together in somebody's living room, and they literally are reading the documents of the Second Vatican Council.
Okay.
And then there are questions and answers afterwards. They go through all of those, too. Cardinal Ritter's idea here is, forget the spirit of the council, which is all over the place. That's Leviathan. But instead, what do the documents say? What are we really learning from this council? And so that's one of the things that he is doing. 2,600 study groups. That blows the little council out of the water. You know, it becomes absolutely irrelevant after that. He also establishes the Archdiocesan Pastoral Council.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that's in October of 1966. And he places at the head of that Father Robert Coletta. And it's going to be made up of 22 members. Many of them are pastors. Others are religious, some laity, and then also some members of the Archdiocesan Curia. And they'll get together and then break down into smaller committees, and they'll be working on specific suggestions.
Okay.
And some of the things that come out of the Archdiocesan Pastoral Council are very important. And some of them are kind of silly, but nonetheless, you know, they're trying to figure out what they can do with this. One of the things they did was they mandated that there be parish councils in each parish, as well as finance committees in each parish. Now, today, by canon law, every parish must have a finance committee. It does not have to have a parish council, but nonetheless, most parishes do.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing they did was they required that any work that would be done in a parish, there would have to be competing bids that would be submitted.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Today we do that a little bit differently than what we did before, but even today a pastor, if he's going to spend over $10,000 on any kind of repair or any kind of work, capital work, he needs to have the permission of the archbishop. And we have a very good buildings and grounds office here in the Archdiocese that really helps pastors with all of these issues. And I know that for a fact because I've been...
You've been in parishes that have needed that.
Have needed that, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they've been very good about that. Some others, they passed a provision that allowed women to come to church without wearing a hat or the mantilla. Then they regulated the amount of mass stipends. So those are very little kind of tiny things. In the end, by the time they finished their work, they had submitted 100 proposals already. So
lots of ideas.
Lots of ideas. Then also Cardinal Ritter farmed together a priest council.
Okay.
He had not had a council before that. It was made up of 20 priests. And I'm not sure how they were selected back then. Today, they're elected by the priests themselves.
Oh, okay.
Up until that time, the communication between himself and the individual priest came through a bulletin. It was simply entitled Inter Nos, Between Us.
Mm-hmm.
And so he would send out these bulletins, which, again, are in the archives, and they're fascinating reading to see what's going on day to day. But now, instead of that, he's going to make use of this priest's council so that if a priest has a question, he can go to a member of the council who would then present and put it on the agenda, and then it would flow from there.
Okay.
When I was first ordained, Archbishop May had something called the Blue Notes because it was printed on blue paper.
Oh, so you know that that was coming from,
yeah.
You right away see that it was coming from.
Right. And its title was Quid Putas. what can you do?
That's cute. I like
yeah.
that.
Another program that he got started was something called Tithing for the Poor, and it's still there today, so that wealthier parishes could send contributions to a central pool which would then give grants to various inner-city parishes and rural parishes and things of that nature. He also opened a high school, John F. Kennedy. It was out in Manchester. It was far out, the closest.
Out west.
Yeah, I mean, the closest diocesan high school would have been Mercy High School in University City.
Oh, wow. Yeah, so, that's a significant difference.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it really is. It was supposed to have been manned by the Christian Brothers. It was going to be co-educational. It was built to accommodate 1,000 students. And then also the firm that built the school was one that was favorite of the Christian Brothers. It's Belly and Belly out of Chicago. And they're famous for a number of things. They use a lot of glass. They're very square buildings, low to the ground, very modern buildings. For the interior light, they use these domes, you know, the kind of opaque domes.
Right.
The problem with them is they leak.
Oh.
And I taught at a school that had those, and you always had buckets around, you know, and you're constantly resealing them over and over again. But the worst part is the brothers had a nickname for them.
Oh.
Remember, the firm is Belly and Belly.
Yeah.
So the brothers call them Belly Buttons. It's B E L L I.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Not with a Y.
Not with a Y. As it turned out, when the school opened, there were no brothers. The Christian Brothers had said that they simply could not staff the school after all. And so it turned out to be mostly lay teachers and some diocesan priests who would be teaching out at Kennedy High School.
Okay.
Yeah. And it turns out that this is something of a trend. The brothers had also refused to go to Grand Bend, Nebraska, when Bishop Forrest had asked them during the council. He had gone to them. And then also they had gotten requests from Jasper, Kentucky, Nashville, Tennessee, and Enid, Oklahoma. And they declined each of those. Brother Lambert Thomas, who was the provincial at the time, had a real sense that as much as he loved the Second Vatican Council and he loved the possibilities of the changes, he had a funny feeling that this was not going to be good news for religious orders. And we'll take a look at that a little bit later on, at his province in particular, and
that
how prescient
he
his...
He was pretty accurate.
Yeah.
Right. Well, we're running shy on time, so okay. I think we probably need to close this one. But sure. Wow, this has been a tremendous look at what was happening and
a lot of stuff.
How Cardinal Ritter attempted to stop a lot of it.
Yeah, Leviathan stirs.
Yes, exactly. Well, shall we close with a prayer and your blessing?
Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning,
is now, and ever shall be.
World without end. Amen.
May Almighty God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Thank you so much, Monsignor.
Okay.